He is a Spanish Muslim. From the his life overlapped the 12th and 13th centuries. He is considered one of the very greatest philosophers ever. His name is Ibn Arabi. Who knows of Ibn Arabi? Nadia here. By the way, I must tell you, Nadia has come all the way from Switzerland to this conference, in a way. And it was nostalgic to have the Swiss in the audience. Okay. Ibn Arabi was a Sufi mystic Muslim, of course, philosopher. And he wrote a very short little, actually it's a letter. It's a personal letter to a friend who wanted to have Ibn Arabi's advice on how to conduct a spiritual retreat. So Ibn Arabi wrote to him with some guidance how to do that. It's a marvelous little book. And that's part of what I want to share with you as we start today. He's talking about what an individual should do whose purpose is to come into a personal, individual retreat and make his way to a direct experience of Allah. This is not the Islam that you see on the front page. If there should be an influence, when you start, he says, as you begin to approach this task, if there should be an influence which alters the constitution, and that is desirable, distinguish between angelic and demonic spiritual influences, think Jesus in the desert, by what you find in yourself when they come to an end. That is, if the influence is angelic, it is followed by coolness and bliss. You will not be aware of any pain. You will not undergo any alteration of form, and the influence leaves knowledge. But if it is demonic, physical disorientation, pain and distress, bewilderment and vileness ensue, and it leaves mental disorder. Protect yourself and do not cease repeating the dhikr in your heart until God drives the demonic influence from it. That is what the situation calls for. And finally, there is one covenant, one agreement that you must make. What I've just said is one covenant. The second covenant is that you will not seek from Allah in retreat anything other than Himself, and that you will not attach your himma, the power of the heart's intention, to anything other than Him. And if everything in the universe should be spread before you, receive it graciously, but do not stop there. Persist in your quest, for He is testing you. If you stay with what is offered, He will escape you. But if you attain Him, nothing will escape you. That's wonderful writing. And a Quaker can relate to that. A Jungian can relate to that. And understand this covenant of attaching to the goal. Let's call it the goal of reaching an elevated consciousness in some form. One must be careful to know the heart's intention. Nothing must be in focus except that goal. So I think that's good guidance for us too. This whole letter is dominated by a theme. Seek the new experience. And if you seek it correctly, you will be met by it. And then Ibn Arabi writes, if you do not stop there, then you'll be led on to the next phase. And if you do not stop there, you'll be led on. A whole succession of if you do not stop there. Very, very important suggestion for psychological development and for some kind of striving to wake up. To wake up in life. That's Ibn Arabi from The Journey to the Lord of Power. Okay, I want to thank you all for last night, for your patience, for listening to me search for my own wavelength and yours and try to get those in match. I think we need a little bit of dance for a while before we actually tune into each other and the group begins to sing together. So today, I want to begin our discussion, probably stretch over the rest of the time, about what I call Act One of our weekend together. This is actually the second lecture, but this is Act One. The first lecture was the prologue. The quote that is the epigram for this lecture is this one. As once the winged energy of delight carried you over childhood's dark abysses, now, beyond your own life, build the great arch of unimagined bridges. For the God wants to know himself in you. How about that? So much is predicated on a knowledge of God and a coming in the direction of the infinite. But this poet says, the God wants to know himself in you. Don't obstruct that. Did you notice the arch? Remember the arch in Ulysses? The arch where through gleams the untraveled lands? The arch is a very powerful archetype. I'm sorry. Okay, now I want to, this is kind of experimental right now. I'd like to start with another very brief quotation, and I want to ask you to think about it for a moment and ask if anybody has an instant response to it. If you do, I would like you to stand and let us share it. I don't want to have an extended time of discussion of it yet. We'll come back to it again later at the end or later in this afternoon. But this is from a Christian resource from the first century, the Gospel of Thomas. I'm sure many of you have read the Gospel of Thomas or are reading it. If you haven't, hurry and get a copy and start to read it. It consists entirely of alleged sayings of Jesus. Now, I can't assure you that the man Jesus said those things, but I can assure you that whoever Thomas was, and he's supposed to have been one of the disciples, made as authentic a record as he could of what he understood of this strange and wonderful young rabbi. This is Logion 2, the second saying in the Gospel of Thomas. Let him who seeks not cease from seeking until he finds. And when he finds, he will be troubled. And when he is troubled, he will marvel. And he will reign over the all. I don't like the little bit of patriarchal sexism in that language, but that's what I have to read what's there. Let him who seeks not cease seeking until he finds. If you don't stop there, do you hear? The 13th century talking through the first, or vice versa. And when he finds, he will be troubled. And when he's troubled, he will marvel, and he will reign over the all. That's Logion 2 in the Gospel of Thomas. I think what I really want to communicate to you all this weekend is encapsulated in Ibn Arabi and his view of the world, and Thomas and his sense of who this man was, that they were all in community with walking through Galilee. Anybody with an instant reaction? Okay, good. Good. I'd be suspicious if you were. I think that little brief saying contains a tremendous amount of spiritual wisdom. Now, we are, after all, here to ask about the process by which knowledge is converted to wisdom. And that, I think, is precisely the gift of the elder person and the thing that is there in the late years to be taken, if you will. Nothing to lose, so to say. So go for it. So in our first session last evening, I indicated some themes in the poem Ulysses that we called archetypal. And these involve such concepts as the notions of the hero's journey, the wise old woman and wise old man, maybe. Boundary and transgression, going over the boundary. Not being unable to resist going over the boundary. The great themes of human experience such as these are what I experience as central pillars in the narrative that I'm trying to build in these four sessions together. And I'll have occasion later to return to them more than once. The hero, wisdom in the person, boundary, transgression. But first, I want to introduce another theme that's essential to what's to come in our discussion, and it's an idea that we have to now hold as both challenging and quite essential to the story we're building up. And this has to do with the basic structure in our thinking process, the way we process experience and thought to arrive at concepts and build systems of knowledge. We have to get more understanding of how it is we create the world. This is what we literally do in the picture that we form of the outside world through sensory apparatus. This is a creation. I dare say there's no way for us to understand what lies outside the door in its essence. We don't see it in its essence as it is. We see it in the way we construct it. And we construct it in our own different ways. So we need to know how that process goes. So here's the question for everybody here. How do you accomplish this fundamental task of thinking about yourself and about the world? And how did you acquire that way of thinking? You're so accustomed to these constructions that you and we all make. That there's a complete sense of elision between the reality and the construction that we've made. They're the same thing, but I dare say they are not. So it's important to realize that we are dealing with constructions in what we experience. Then, if that's so, the constructions that the unconscious psyche delivers to us in its own particular ways, dreams, visions, fantasies, have to be trusted in their own way as material, as real. How many times in talking about their dream life do people say to me, well, in real life, I don't ever have that kind of experience. I'm saying, wait a minute. What you had last night when you were sleeping is as real as what we have right now. The dream is real. It is, after all, a construct of the mind. And its construction is happening in a somewhat different way. But its reality is not disturbed. And this is a powerful conclusion. In fact, I think it ennobles the whole idea of the constructions that the unconscious makes and delivers to us. Delivers to dream consciousness and the little bit of the ego that's always present in these moments to report back. Otherwise, we'd never know. So that's our task. How do we construct the world? How did you acquire the pattern that you have? And how do you go about that fundamental task of thinking about yourself and the world? So that's the leading question of the afternoon. Jung has written a short, but I dare say seminal essay with the title Two Kinds of Thinking. Many of you know that short piece already. I think it's only 30-some pages long. That's short for you. So, Two Kinds of Thinking. and one he names directed or logical or thinking in words. And that's what we're doing right now, what I'm doing right now. And the other is called non-directed or associative or of the character of dream fantasies. You know, he doesn't value either one over the other in that definition. Neither should we. The two kinds of thinking that Jung was able to identify in his own thought are directed, logical, what I've called rational, objective. You can have all kinds of synonyms for thinking in words. It's just simply another way to construct a form of reality. And non-directed, associative, or of the character of dream fantasies, obviously of a different kind, but not distinguished in its value. We could call that second type symbolic thinking, since it operates not with observations. I'll come to that in a moment. It operates primarily with images, narratives, characters, actions, and so forth, and the meanings they convey. That type of thinking that creates an inner world with as much reality as any other one we know, Ibn Arabi also speaks to that. He describes actually three levels of knowledge. And I can share those with you just briefly, although I don't want that to be too much of a digression. In the cosmos, the 13th century Sufi philosopher saw three worlds. The top world is the world of spirits. The second world is the world of images and the imagination. Now, this does not use the word imagination in the same sense that we would speak of something as being imaginary, just cooked up. It means imaginal, which means something different. It means having the whole substance of the imaginal faculty of the psyche. That's the middle realm. And the bottom realm is the world of bodies, the world of spirits, the world of images, and the world of bodies. Now, I mention that because I want you to see how, what is it now, 1,000 years ago? Another person in another part of the world with another culture was already thinking in similar ways and being led to these conclusions. Now, that tells me that the archetypal psyche, you remember that? All of that psychic life that lies down below the personal level is an active force in the world and has been for centuries. So when we discover a person like Jung, we appreciate intensely what he has brought to our own times, but we don't imagine that there's anything totally novel in that. It's as if the archetypal psyche is working on the basic raw material of the human psyche through centuries. I would even imagine through millennia. And that's really a very sobering thought.